We are, after our little excursion into Jataka stories, we're now resuming our study of the Majjhima Nikaya, and as it happens, I assure you it's a complete coincidence, starting with a Jataka story. King Makadeva, which is one of the couple of dozen Jataka stories that are found in the Nikayas as such, and this is one of the most famous of all of the Jatakas, as is attested by the proliferation of alternative versions. And here we find one version in the Madhyama Agama, which of course was translated by Sangadeva. Thank you. Very good. Gautama Sangadeva. A text of the school of the Sarvasivadins. Thank you very much, Aya. And next is a version of the Ekotra Agama, which is of unknown school but is often said to be Mahasangika, but that's really just a guess. And then we have these two independent suttas in the Chinese Jataka collections, and we have another partial corresponding sutta also in the Ekotra Agama, or at the beginning of the Ekotra Agama, and another partial translation. This is in the, I believe, in the Mulasarasivada Vinaya, in the Chinese translation, in the Bhaisadhyavatstu. And it occurs twice, or parts of it occur in two distinct Pali Jataka stories, as well as in the Tibetan, and this is the Duba. Oh, I didn't know we had that text on there. Which is the Tibetan Vinaya. Mulasarasivada Vinaya, and here it is in Tibetan. Oh, cool. Yeah. Very good. Anyone know Tibetan? Yeah. Yeah. And that first bit says Vinaya. I know that much. There you go. So, anyone who reads Tibetan, do yourself a favour. And another version in somewhere in the Tibetan canon. I'm not sure where that one is, but it does appear in the, as Venerable Nādhu explains, in the Bhaisajya Vastu, which is the chapter on medicines, as it happens, in the Tibetan Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. And just being Venerable Nādhu's summary of the different versions, the sutta. Makadeva Sutta, discourse on Makadeva, is a Jataka tale of a past life of the Buddha as a king. And it should be noted that in the early Jatakas, the Jatakas within the Nikayas, for Nikayas, then or agamas, that the Buddha is always a king or a sage in the past. He's never an animal or something like that. This discourse has a parallel in the Madhyama Agama and Ekotara Agama. Parts of the same discourse recur also in the introductory section of the Ekotara Agama. Events described in Makadeva Sutta are also recorded in Pali Jataka collection in the Bhaisajya Vastu of the Tibetan Mulasarvastivada Vinaya and in the Satparamita Sangraha Sutra, a collection of tales of former existences of the Buddha, assembled under the heading of the Six Perfections. The story, and that is, and that's one of the ones in Chinese that we looked at before. The story of King Nini, which occurs as the latter part of the Makadeva Sutra in the Chinese discourse, parallels, recurs moreover as a tale on its own in the Pali Jataka and the Chinese Dharmapada Avadana collections. Okay, the Sanskrit version of the Bhaisajyavastu of the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya only briefly refers to the present tale, indicating that the details should be supplied from the Mahadeva Sutra, found in the chapter on kings of the Madhyama Agama, which is quite interesting. So this is what it actually says in the text. So this is the what's sometimes referred as the Gilgit manuscripts, which we have the books of these here. Unfortunately, they're in Devanagari script. Visarena Mahadeva Sutre Madhyamagame Raja Sanyukta Nipate. So this is a Sanskrit note, and it says, and it literally says in full or in extenso, okay, in the Mahadeva Sutra, in the Madhyama Agama, in the collection or the chapter connected with kings. Okay, so this is a little note that's provided in the Mulasarvasti Vardavinia, the Sanskrit version of it. In other words, it's assuming that you've got access to these texts and it's referring you over to them. Whereas, say, in the Tibetan version of the same scripture, it has the text given there in full. And here we have a similar thing referring to the Nimi Sutra, Nimi being a character from the Mahadeva Sutra. Vistarena Nimi Sutra Madhyamagame Raja Sanyukta Nipate. Okay, so... And the Chinese Mulasarvasti Vardavinia has a similar note. So these are some of the indications that give us an idea of how these texts would have worked, that they weren't conceived as entirely independent things. There was a degree of interdependence. Obviously, the editors of this particular text knew of that other text, and they expected that other people should be familiar with it or should have access to it, so they could refer over from one to the other. This indication accords with the actual location of the present discourse in the Chinese Madhyama Agama collection. The Sanskrit Bhaisharya Vastu has another four such references to Madhyama Agama discourses, each time specifying the chapter where the discourses are to be found. Each of these references corresponds to the location of the equivalent discourse in the Chinese Madhyama Agama. Although the locations correspond to the indications given in the Bhaisharya Vastu, all the five Chinese discourses have titles that differ from the titles mentioned in the Bhaisharya Vastu. Contrast between the close agreement on the location of the discourse within the Madhyama Agama collection and the disagreement on its respective title suggests that even after the discourses had been allocated to particular chapters in the collection, their titles were still amenable to change. And then refers to a previous discussion. So that's fairly obvious anyway. There's quite a few cases even within the Pali scriptures where the titles of sutras may be quite flexible and called different things in different places. The Sinhala tradition might have a different title than the Burmese tradition or something like that. Okay, and also just to notice, as you might have already noticed, that the name Mahadeva is a bit variable. In some, he's got a note down here about that. Here we have with some cases it's Mahadeva, in some places Maghadeva, in some places Mahadeva, and so on. So it seems to be some uncertainty dating from quite an early period to what the exact form of the name was. Obviously, Mahadeva is the normal title, it's a very common word, common name. So one might invoke the principle of, what is it, lectio, how do you say? Oh, divina, which means?
A prayerful reading.
Yeah, no, I wasn't thinking of lectio divina, but it's close. It's another principle. This is not a prayerful reading. It's called lectio difficult law or something. I can never remember how to say the Latin. Anyway, it means one should prefer the difficult reading. So it's more likely that someone would read Mahadeva and normalize it to Mahadeva than would happen the other way around. And on the Bharhut Stupa, we have a reference to Maghadeva. So that's a very early reference. That's no doubt by far the earliest actual textual source referring to the name. It's about 100 BC or something. We have Maghadeva. May well have been different in different dialects in India.
Does it mean the same thing?
No. Mahadeva, Maha, you know, means grey. Magha and Magha, I don't know if they mean anything. Magha, I think, was a name of Saka, the god.
I'm not sure if they mean anything other than an actual name. Yeah, they're a little bit unusual. But they could be, the Indic languages do oscillate between those consonants, so it could be just a dialectical difference. So that's just a little bit of the background for the sutta. So now we'll read a little bit through here. So reading from the Pali version and Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation made available to us through the magnanimity generosity of Google Books. Right. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Mithila in the Makadeva mango grove. So Mithila being located a little bit north and west of Vaisali, south of Kapilavastu. Then in a certain place the Blessed One smiled. It occurred to the Venerable Ananda, what is the reason, what is the cause for the Blessed One's smile? The Tathagatas do not smile for no reason. So he arranged his upper robe on one shoulder and extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Buddha, the Blessed One. He asked him, Venerable Sir, what is the reason, what is the cause for the Blessed One's smile? The Tathagatas do not smile for no reason. Okay, so here's the classic invitation to speak and origin of the story. The Makadeva Sutta and its Madhyama Agama Ekottara Agama parallels begin with the Buddha displaying a smile. While the Pali and Chinese discourses simply indicate that he smiled, the introductory section of the Ekottara Agama and the Saptaparamita Sangraha Sutra describe that lights of five different colours emanated from the Buddha's mouth when he displayed this smile. So obviously there being a direct parallel between this passage and certain toothpaste advertisements, which is the No, it's not. No, that's something different. So, okie dokie. Okay, once another, in this very same Mithila, there was a king named Makadeva. He was a righteous king who ruled by the Dhamma, a great king who was established in the Dhamma. He conducted himself by the Dhamma among Brahmins and householders, among town dwellers and country folk, and he observed the Upasita days on the 14th, 15th and 8th of the fortnight. Now at the end of many years, many hundred years, many thousand years, King Makadeva, so see, notice it doesn't give details as to what the Dhamma is here, but there's just a couple of indications of what the Dhamma might mean. By the Dhamma among Brahmins and householders, town dwellers and country folk, and that would mean that there were certain kind of royal duties and responsibilities which were accepted to be like what they call a Raja Dhamma, which would be for protection and looking after people in those different kinds of people. And keeping the Upasita. So, of course, the Upasita, as always, is regarded as being a pre-Buddhist practice, as it no doubt was. Now, at the end of many years, many hundred years, many thousand years, King Makadeva addressed his Baba thus. So interesting that the Baba plays a very significant role here in this particular story. Good Baba. When you see any grey hairs growing on my head, then tell me. Yes, sire, he replied. And after many years, many hundred years, many thousand years, the Baba saw grey hairs growing on King Makadeva's head. When he saw them, he said to the king, the divine messengers have appeared, sire. Grey hairs are to be seen growing on your majesty's head. Then, good Baba, pull out those grey hairs carefully with tweezers and put them on my palm. Yes, sire, he replied. He pulled out those grey hairs carefully with tweezers and put them in the king's palm. Then King Makadeva gave the boon of a village to his Baba, and calling the prince, his eldest son, he said, dear prince, the divine messengers have appeared. Grey hairs are seen growing on my head. I have enjoyed human sensual pleasures. Now it is time to seek divine sensual pleasures. Come, dear prince,
take over the kingship. I shall shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. And now, dear prince, when you too see grey hairs growing on your head, and after giving the boon of a village to your barber, and after carefully instructing the prince, your eldest son, in kingship, shave off your hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Continue this good practice instituted by me, and do not be the last man. Dear prince, when there are two men living, he is the last man, he under whom there occurs a breach of this good practice, he is the last man among them. Therefore, dear prince, I say to you, continue this good practice instituted by me, and do not be the last man. Then after giving the boon of the village to his barber, and after carefully instructing the prince, his eldest son, in kingship in the Mahadeva mango grove, he shaved off his hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So a few notes in order. One thing, it's interesting how quite a big deal is made of this thing of giving the village to the barber. And Analia has a bit of a note here. Chinese versions do not mention such a grant. To give away a major village may indeed seem an exaggerated way of rewarding the services of a barber who, after all, had only carried out a simple order. I'm not quite necessarily convinced by that kind of argument. It seems that he's been given the village as a sense for gratitude for showing him the divine messengers. But in any case, interesting that in some places there's different versions on that, and then the Jatakas go into detail about why why he gave the gift of a village to the barber. And also interesting to notice that the description of going forth, shaving off the hair and beard, putting on the yellow robe, and going forth from the home life into homelessness, of course, is exactly the same way as going forth is depicted in Buddhism. So this again being depicted as not a specifically Buddhist thing. He abided, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abided, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abided, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, or with altruistic joy, or with equanimity. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abided, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So here we have the standard description of the four Brahma Viharas, Metta, Karuna, Mudita, and Upekha. And of course, this description being found countless times within the early scriptures, it's perhaps significant that this description is found commonly in all the early scriptures, but it's found more commonly in the Sarvastivadin scriptures than in the Pali. But of course found very commonly in the Pali as well, and just gives a brief commentary on the passage here. It starts here, so metta sahagatena chetasa, so being more or less a particle here. Metta meaning loving kindness, of course, derived from the word mitta meaning friend. Sahagatena, saha is literally together, gata is gone. So literally metta sahagatena is like with a mind that's got, like gone or imbued with or filled with. Gata is used in an abstract sense. It literally means gone, but used in an abstract sense. Chetasa, the cheta or chetas is one of the words that's used in Pali for the mind, there being quite a few more or less synonyms. But cheto or chetas is most commonly used in this kind of context, where it refers more to an emotional centre rather than, say, to an intellectual or to a willing centre or to consciousness, we say, as vijnana. So it's difficult to It's difficult, and it's an ongoing controversy in sort of Abhidhamma and as well as in modern Buddhist studies, to what extent the different words for the mind in the Buddhist texts actually mean different things. Okay, so some people say they all mean the same thing. Citta, mano, vijnana, and so on all mean the same thing. Other people say they mean different things. But certainly there's no doubt that they're used with a different emphasis and in different contexts. And so cetas or ceto is the one that's used in this kind of context, a more emotional context. Cetasa. So please do ask questions as we're going along with this. That's right, yeah, often could be translated. Although the texts do use hadaya, which is literally the heart as well. Yeah, it's the pumping heart. Although hadaya is used fairly rarely. It's more of a poetic term. Yeah. Okay, ekang in one direction, ekang disang, having pervaded, one abides, or he abided. The same for the second, the same for the third, the same for the fourth. Iti, thus, above and below, all around. Sabbadhi is everywhere. Sabbatataya. And this one's a little bit controversial, is exactly how to break it up, but most likely or most common way of breaking it up is sabba is all, atta is oneself, and ta is an abstractive ending, and the aya form of that abstractive ending means for. So for each as to oneself, or to all as to oneself, is how it's usually translated. Sabba vantang. Again, is like the all-encompassing or something like that. Lokang, the world. Again, metta sahagatena, with a mind imbued or filled with loving kindness. Vipulena, which is vipula. Vipula meaning expanded or big, basically. Mahagatena, maha, and then gata. Again, this gata used as a suffix in the sense of like become, so heart become great. Appamanena, and this one, the root here is mana, meaning measure. Pamana, meaning similarly, meaning measure. Pamana doesn't modify the meaning all that much, but up being a negative. So appamana, measureless. Averena, the root here being vera, is anger, ill will, without anger. And abhyapajha, again meaning ill will or hostility, something like that, a negative form of that. Paritva, having pervaded. Vihasi, so parati is the verb to pervade.
How does this description extend it to interpret, like when you say putting into a quarter of this, a quarter of that,
mm-hmm.
interpret as you first, you know, start with yourself and to your loved one, is it a later development?
Yeah, that particular scheme is a later development, yeah.
So yeah. Is there another interpretation?
Not really. That's not here. I mean, the only sort of seed of that is the phrase "to each as to oneself" or "to all as to oneself." So we're starting from that, which is found a few times. But the actual idea of like the, you know, oneself, loved one, neutral one, disliked person, that's only found in the Visuddhimagga. That's not found in any early scriptures. So this is a very nice passage to chant. A very good one to learn and to chant. It's got a nice swing to it. Karuna sahagatena, karuna compassion, mudita joy in the success of others, and upekha, of course, equanimity, literally upa ikha, which is upa ikha means to watch, and upa meaning watching over or closely watching. There's a literal meaning of upekha, is to closely watching something.
This is a description of a jhana practice or jhana state, which is very clear from the kind of language, the Mahagata and the Appamana and so on. These are all terms used for jhana. So this is like a description of the result of the Brahmavihara practice rather than being a meditation method as such. This being quite characteristic of the suttas, that they actually, for better or for worse, they tell you much more about the states of meditation to be reached than they do about the detail. I mean, there are certain things that tell you about the meditation method, but there's not all that much in the early suttas, apart from what you find in the Satipatthana Sutta and a few other places. Okay, and so of course this practice being depicted here as a pre-Buddhist practice, and one which as the Brahmaviharas has been adopted from the very loosely speaking Brahmanical tradition. Although you notice that, I mean, there's this kind of ongoing discussion about, you know, was the Buddha a Hindu, and how much was the society called a Hindu society or anything, but you notice that in that description so far, there's been precisely nothing about Hinduism as such in the description of what they're doing. There's no mention of the Vedas or Vedic rituals or anything like that. So of course those descriptions are found in many places, but it's important not to just read an assumption into texts that somehow everything in ancient India before the Buddha arrived was Hindu. This is clearly not the case. There was a diverse and complex spiritual and ethical and philosophical environment, and in the sutta like this, in the Makadeva Sutta, it sounds to me like it's the description of his practice previously, where he was focusing on the Dhamma and practicing the Dhamma equally for all these different groups of people. It sounds to me like a Ashoka Dhamma, really. It's like that's how King Ashoka's practice was. He was very much focused on just what is the Dhamma and encouraging people to do good and so on and so forth, rather than being mixed up with Vedic rituals and so on as such. So then of course there is the quite well established idea in the Indic sphere of renouncing and going forth and so on. And interestingly enough, when I spoke on the Brahmaviharas briefly at the Parliament of World Religions, one of the fellows in the audience was a Jaina practitioner. And he came up and he was quite thrilled because he said that they have exactly the same thing in the Jaina tradition. They phrase them a little bit differently. I think they have Maitri, I think Mudita have a slightly different word for it, but that's the second one, and Karuna is the third, and instead of Upekkha they have Madhyastha, which literally means standing in the middle, using another word for equanimity. So not only in the Brahmanical and the Buddhist traditions, but also in the Jaina tradition. So all of the kind of main existing Indian spiritual traditions to share this practice. For 84,000 years, King Mahadeva played childish games. Right? He was on his Xbox for 84,000 years. For 84,000 years, he acted as vice-regent. For 84,000 years he governed the kingdom. For 84,000 years he led the holy life in this Mahadeva mango grove, after shaving off his hair and beard, putting on the yellow robe and going forth from the home life into homelessness. By developing the four divine abidings on the dissolution of the body after death, he passed on to the Brahma world. Now at the end of many years, many hundred years, many thousand years, King Mahadeva's son addressed his Baba. And then all happened as before. And the descendants of King Mahadeva's son, to the number of 84,000 kings in succession, after shaving off their hair and beard and putting on the yellow robe, went forth from the home life into homelessness in this Makadeva grove. They abided, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. For 84,000 years they played childish games. 84,000 years they acted as vice regents. For 84,000 years they governed the kingdom. For 84,000 years they led the holy life. By developing the four divine abidings on the dissolution of the body after death, they passed on to the Brahma world. Nimi was the last of those kings. He was a righteous king who ruled by the Dhamma, a great king who was established in the Dhamma. He conducted himself by the Dhamma among Brahmins and householders, town dwellers and country folk, and he observed the Upasita days on the 14th, 15th and 8th of the fortnight. Once Ananda, when the gods of the 33 had met together and were seated in the Sudhamma assembly, this discussion arose among them. It is a gain, sirs, for the people of Videha. It is a great gain for the people of Videha that their king Nimi is a righteous king who rules by the Dhamma, a great king who is established in the Dhamma. He conducts himself by the Dhamma, and so on. Then Saka, ruler of gods, addressed the gods of the 33. Good sirs, do you want to see King Nimi? And they said, good sir, we do want to see King Nimi. Now, on that occasion, it being the Upasita day of the 15th, King Nimi had washed his head and ascended to the upper palace chamber, where he was seated for the Upasita observance. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, Saka, ruler of gods, vanished among the gods of the 33 and appeared in the presence of King Nimi. He said, it is a gain for you, great king, it is a great gain for you, great king. When the gods of the 33 met together, they said they would like to see you. I shall send a chariot harnessed to a thousand thoroughbreds for you, great king. Great king, mount the divine chariot without misgiving. Then Saka vanished and reappeared among the 33. Okay, then Saka, ruler of gods, addressed his charioteer, Matali. Come, good Matali. Address, prepare a chariot harness to 1,000 thoroughbreds and go to King Nimi and say, good, great king, this chariot harnessed to 1,000 thoroughbreds has been sent for you by Saka, ruler of gods. Great king, mount the divine chariot without misgiving. So this is what he did. And then when he went to King Nimi, he said, great king, mount the divine chariot without misgiving, but great king, by which route shall I drive you? By that on which doers of evil experience the results of evil actions, or on that on which doers of good experience the results of good actions? Drive me by both routes, Matali. Just give come back to Analio's essay here and just catch up there on some notes. Okay, when treating the succession of kings from Makadeva to Nimi, the Ekotara Agama version reports that 7 days after the going forth of the king, the seven treasures of a wheel-turning king disappeared. So the seven treasures of the wheel-turning king and the motif of the wheel-turning king found elsewhere in the Pali scriptures, but not found in this particular sutta. So this being a further development in the Ekotara Agama version. And then he asked his father for advice. His father explained to his son that the seven treasures were not inheritable. Again, this idea is found in the Pali elsewhere. He then instructed his son to rightly rule the kingdom, as then the seven treasures will reappear. A similar account is found in the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta in the Pali canon. Pali and Chinese accounts report in similar terms that the gods of the 33 wanted to see Nimi, and Makadeva and its Chinese parallels indicate that Nimi wanted to be taken to heaven along both the lower and the higher paths, the path leaving where evildoers experience retribution and the path leading through the spheres where wholesome conduct is experienced. The three discourses refer to this journey only in brief, while the Jataka tale treats this journey in considerable detail. And in explaining the Jatakas here, that the journey took so long that Saka had to repeatedly intervene to urge his charioteer to move on. All right? And a little note here that the idea of 1,000 horses is not mentioned in all the versions. So I don't know if we want to, you want to get the version of the visits to heaven and hell? We can find that in the Jatakas. Anyone interested to know what heaven and hell is like? I didn't bring the Jataka book, I have to pop down and get it.
It would be Jataka 9 and 541. I'm not sure which one's in.
Going by the time stats here, that would be well before the Big Bang.
Well, that's a point made by Analeo as well. Yeah, he did the math. Yeah, 9 and 541. Yeah. This is Jataka 541, the mini Jataka. Here's the trip to heaven and hell. So according to this one, he said, I'd like to go to both, and Martali said, well, you can't see both at once, and then he said, okay, which place would you like to go to first? And then Nimi thought, well, after I die, I'm going to go to heaven anyway, so might as well go to hell. Then he just showed him where Tarani, the river of hell. Okay, and to explain this, then there's some verses. A river sinking full of corrosive brine, hot, covered all with burning flames of fire. The king was terrified when he saw creatures thus sorely tormented in Vaitarani and asked Martali what sins they had done. And the verse says, then Nimi, when he saw the people fall in this deep river flood, asked Martali, fear comes on me to see it, charioteer, tell me, what is the sin these mortals did who are cast in the river? He replied, describing how sin ripens and bears fruit. Who in the world of life are strong themselves, yet hurt the weak, oppress them, doing sin. These cruel creatures begat sin, and they are cast into the stream, Vaitarani. Then another went to another hell and described it, black dogs and speckled vultures, flocks of crows most horrid, prey upon these people. When I look, fear seizes me. What sins have these committed? And Martali replied, these are the churls, the misers, foul of tongue, to Brahmins and ascetics that do hurt these cruel creatures begat sin, and they are those you see of ravens here, the prey. And then another one, their bodies all ablaze and they lie prostrate, pounded with red hot lumps. What sins have they committed? And Martali said, these in the world of life were sinful men who hurt and did torment those without sin. Both men and women, sinful as they were, these cruel creatures begat sin, and they now lie there, beaten with the red-hot lumps. And another one, people struggling in a pit of coals, roaring, their bodies charred. And these were people who, before a crowd of men, suborned a witness and forswore a debt. Another one were in a blazing, flaming, all one mass of fire. I see an iron cauldron, huge and great. What have they done? And he said, whoever who has hurt a Brahmin or an ascetic, foul men of sin, and he a virtuous man, these creatures now fall headlong into the iron bowl. Another one, they wring them by the neck and cast them in, filling the cauldron full of boiling water. What do these people do? These are the wicked men who in the world caught birds and destroy them, great king, thus destroying our creatures. They lie yonder with their own necks wrung. Another one, there flows a river deep with shallow banks, easy of access. Thither go the men scorched with the heat and drink, but as they drink, the water turns to chaff, which when I see fears seizes upon me. It reminds me of the torment of Tantalus, where he was in the hell, and there always the water would appear before him, and he'd be so thirsty, and when he reached for it, it would disappear, and the fruits would come for him, and he would be so hungry, and when he reached for them, the fruits would go away. So, of course, this being the origin of the word tantalize.
Yeah? What is that Greek?
That's Greek, yeah. It's a similar kind of milieu. And so those ones, who when they go to get the cool water, it turns to chaff. These men are those who mixed good grain with chaff and sold it to a buyer doing ill. Oh dear. Crooked merchants. With spikes and spears and arrowheads, they pierce these loudly wailing folk on either side. So what did they do? Well, these were ones who took what was not theirs and lived upon it, goats, sheep, cattle, bulls, corn, treasure, silver and gold. And they lie riddled with the spears. What about these others who are fastened by the neck, some cut into pieces, others all torn up?
What did they do? These were fishers and butchers, hunters of the boar, slayers of cattle, bulls and goats, who slew and lay the corpses in the slaughterhouse. Well, another one. What about the lake of filth and stinking foul excrement with evil scent unclean, where starving men eat of the contents? Who lies there devouring dirt and filth? These are malicious persons who, for hurt of others, lived with them and harmed their friends. There's another one. The lake is full of blood and stinking foul with evil scent unclean, where scorched with heat the men drink the contents. These is where those go who have slain a mother or father, who they should reverence, excommunicate these cruel, being cut off, these cruel creatures begat sin, and they are those who drink the drink of blood. That again being a common motif in Greek mythology, the shades of the dead will drink the blood of the sacrifices. That tongue, see, pierced with a hook, like as a shield stuck with 100 barbs. And who are those who struggle, leaping like a fish on land and roaring, drabbled spittle? When I see it, fear seizes upon me. These are men who in the marketplace, haggling and cheapening from their greed of gain, have practiced knavery and thought it hidden, like one that hooks a fish. What about the men and what about the women? Bent and broken, stretching their arms and wailing, wretched, smeared with stains of blood, like cattle in the shambles, they stand waist deep, buried in earth, with their upper body ablaze. What did they do? They were of noble birth when in the world. They lived lives unclean, did deeds of wickedness, were traitors, left their husbands, and besides did other things to satisfy their lust. Why, and do they seize yon persons by the legs and cast them headlong into Naraka, an abyss full of blazing coals, according to the commentary? What did they do? These in the world did evil, did seduce another's wife, stole his most precious things, and now they're cast headlong in Naraka. This is the adulterers. But then the most terrible, many and various causes I've seen, most terrible among these hells. Why is this one even worse than all the rest? Okay, the worst hell of all. Why must they suffer this excessive pain, so sharp, so cruel, so intolerable? Any guesses? What's the worst hell? But what? Well, yeah. Okay. But what? What do they do? Who goes to the Avicii hell? Who goes? No, it's not actually called Avicii here, but it's just said to be the worst of them. But who? Someone causes. Who causes schisms? Someone who supports Bhikkhuni ordination. Time for heinous crimes. Sorry? Ah, exactly, yeah. He's got it. Who's in the world were wicked heretics who put their faith in false delusion and who converted others to their heresy. They, by the heresy begetting sin, suffer this pain. It doesn't give it too much detail, it just says that it's the worst, you know. But it's, I know it's just what it says here.
So this kind
of bit hard to say. The Jatakas are the Jatakas were very widely definitely not. This the Jatakas are used widely as popular literature. And so, as I mentioned before, this is actually mentioned, or at least a version of it. So we've seen there's many different versions of it, but the name is actually mentioned in an inscription on one of the ancient Buddhist monuments. So that, you know, that shows it had a sort of a wide popular currency. And these being sort of, you don't really get the flavour of it so much from those passages, but mostly they're collections of folk tales. Really is what they are. Yeah. So this kind of lurid description of heavens and hells being something which is quite common in popular religious literature in India.
Yeah.
You find it, I think, in medieval Christian literature as well. Some of the legends. Yeah. Sorry?
I mean, every religion has its own
motif. Yeah. 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 There's nothing specific.
Do you have any idea if this means that there is a
It's hard to say, but they're certainly shared pretty much among all the traditions. So, yeah.
So, like, were they already in Indian culture?
Again, hard to say. I don't actually know any specific examples of things that are earlier than the Buddha that contain this kind of description. Yeah.
Are they actually in
similar
descriptions as
another
sutta's
in the Majjhima
that
actually
talk about
health and therefore? That's right, yeah, it's not all the same details, but we'll get to that one in due course. But yeah, there are a couple in the Nikayas that talk about that. But certainly more characteristic of later literature to go on about details. So of course, interesting also the important role played by Martali, the charioteer here. You know, the charioteer being a very significant figure, of course, Channa, the charioteer that took the Buddha from the home, and also Krishna being the charioteer in the Bhagavad Gita. And then Sakka at this point interjects and says, Martali's been gone such a long time, he's going showing everyone, showing him all the different hells and so on. Go and tell Martali to tell the king, bring the king up. He doesn't have to go to all the hells, he'll be there forever. So then he did that, and then he took him to see some of the heavens. Okay, so now we have some of the descriptions of the heavens, and this is the description of the goddess Birani, Catwoman. No, not Birani, Catwoman, no, something like that. Behold yon mansion with five pinnacles, there decked with garlands, lies upon a couch a most puissant woman. How do you say that? P-U-I-S-S-A-N-T. I don't think anyone's actually said that for the last 100 years. But how do you say it in English, you know? In English. Puissant. Almost. Any guesses? Any suggestions? Puissant. The most puissant woman who assumes all kinds of majesty and wondrous power, joys that come upon me to see it. But tell me, Martali, what were her good deeds? Blah, blah, blah. And then why has she been born in that place? She was a Brahmin's slave, a servant in the home of a Brahmin's house. Remembering that a slave in ancient India was more like a bonded labourer. Doesn't mean she was like kind of chained up and whipped and things like that, but just as somebody who would work in the household, who once received a guest at the right moment, welcomed him as a mother might her son, and therefore now she lives happy in this mansion. Yeah? That's pretty good. Yeah? It just says that they received a guest, but that's actually very important, because in ancient civilizations the virtue of receiving guests was very strongly emphasized, you know, and especially because people would be traveling and they'd be tired and dirty from their travels, and so to receive someone with kindness was considered very, very important. Again, this is something which features very heavily in a lot of the Greek mythology. The virtues of receiving hospitality. Mm.
Also, both
and that's the complexity of karma. So that's what most of us are at, yeah. So it could be either, but this is saying that it was that specific karma. But also, there are other stories where it talks about somebody who, you know, like, you know, was virtuous and generous during the daytime, but nighttime went drinking and gambling and so on. So they get reborn as a preta in the night and a deva in the day. So, yeah. Okay, next one. Sonadina. This one's for Sonadina, who gave with royal bounty and for hermits wrought seven hermitages, all their needs. He faithfully provided food, bedding to lie on, clothes to wear, and light. Contented with those men of life upright, he kept the Sabbath day, and each fortnight the 8th and 14th and 15th days. generous, controlled, he walked in holy ways, so now dwells in this mansion of delight. And then next he drove onwards and saw a mansion of crystal. In height it was 5 and 20 leagues. Imagine cleaning all that glass. It had hundreds of columns made of the 7 precious things, hundreds of pinnacles. It was set about with lattices and little bells. The banner of gold and silver flew. Beside it was a park and grove full of many bright flowers, with a lovely lake of lilies. Nymphs cunning to sing and to make music were there in plenty. Then I can see Bhante James really looking forward to this heavenly rebirth thing. He's practicing the same. And then he said, okay, well, this place with a throng of goodly women skilled in dance and song, where does that come from? And then it says, these women ever walked in holy ways, faithful lay sisters, they kept the holy days, generous, controlled, and watchful, serene in heart, and now they rejoice happy in the mansion you've seen. Okay, next one. Another one is a mansion built of jewels, shining bright, symmetrical, proportioned, a fair sight, where divine melody, wherein divinest melody around, songs, dances, drums, and tabors do resound. I never have beheld a sight so fair, nor sound so sweet, have ever heard, I swear. And so what did they do? These were lay brethren in the world of men, provided parks or water and so on for, and did feed the tranquil saints. Found clothes, drink and bedding, every need, contented those with who lived well and so on. So there's another one. So the next one is another crystal mansion with many pinnacles, all manners of flowers and fine trees echoing with the songs of birds of all kinds by which flowed a river of pure water.
Is this the
Amitabha? No, this is the Jataka. Yon mansion built of crystal shining bright, its pinnacles uplifted in the height with food and drink in plenty and a throng of goodly women skilled in dance and song and rivers fringed with many a flower and tree. Joy seizes upon me. And at Kimbila, a householder was he. He bounteous gave parks and wells and faithfully drew water, and this tranquil saints did feed, and so on and so forth. And then another one with royal trees and mangoes and rose apple sweet and so on and so forth. And what did they do? And then he was a generous householder who fed the tranquil saints and so on and so forth. And it goes on more or less in the same kind of vein. Doesn't take too long for heaven to get a bit tedious, does it?
No.
Yeah. My crystal palace is better than your crystal palace. So there's some idea of how heaven and heaven were conceived. In the popular Buddhist imagination. So, just coming back to Analia's few notes before returning to the sutta, but it gives some example in some of the other versions of why the gods of the 33 would want to see Nimi, and it suggested that they had been previously his subjects who'd been encouraged to do good underneath him and had been reborn in the Tavatinga to heaven because of his teaching, and so this is why they wanted to see him. Okie dokie, so coming back to the sutta itself. Matali brought King Nimi to the Sudama assembly. Saka, ruler of gods, saw King Nimi coming in the distance. This is kind of a note. It seems a bit curious to me that they've opened up this opportunity to go and visit the heavens and hells, which they kind of, in this Pali text, they haven't taken. And the Jataka sort of fills it in as one would expect. But the Majjhima Nikaya version, it just says that, and then he gets to the king, to the gods of the 33, and I find it a bit curious that the redactors sort of missed that, almost like this kind of invitation to get into some nice descriptions of heavens and hells and things. You would have thought they wouldn't have passed that up. So maybe something which could have been filled out in the oral tradition.
Do you think that it could have been quite a simple story, and the Jataka just sort of elaborated and made it all
to some degree, of course, but the fact that he says drive me by both routes, Matali, and then completely misses that out, it seems to me a bit odd.
Yeah.
So Saka, the ruler of gods, saw King Nimi coming up to the distance and said to him, "Come, great king, welcome, great king. The gods of the 33 seated in the Sudama assembly have expressed themselves thus. It is again, sirs." And so on. So, "Come, great king, enjoy divine might among the gods." "Enough, good sir. Let the charioteer drive me back to Mithila. There I will conduct myself well by the Dhamma and observe the Uposatha." And then he said, "Okay, so I'll take him back." Then Saka, ruler of gods, told the charioteer Matali, "Come, good Matali, prepare the chariot harness to 1,000 thoroughbreds and drive King Nimi back to Mithila." "Yes, your honour," said the charioteer of Matali, replied, and having prepared the chariot harness to 1,000 thoroughbreds, he drove King Nimi back to Mithila, and there indeed King Nimi conducted himself by the Dhamma. At the end of many years, many hundred years, many thousand years, King Nimi addressed his Baba, and so on, and then he died and practiced the Brahma Viharas and passed on to the Brahma world. Now King Nimi had a son named Kala Rajanaka. He did not go forth from the home life into homelessness. He broke that good practice. He was the last man among them. Now Ananda, it may be that you think thus. Certainly on that occasion someone else was King Makadeva who instituted that good practice, but it should not be regarded thus. I was King Makadeva on that occasion. I instituted that good practice, and later generations continued that good practice instituted by me. So here is the identification of this as a Jataka story. But that kind of good practice does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the Brahma world. But there is this kind of good practice that has been instituted by me now, which does lead to complete enchantment, to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And what is that good practice? It is this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is the good practice that leads to nibbana. Ananda, I say to you, continue this good practice instituted by me and do not be the last man. Ananda, when there are two men living, he under whom there occurs a breach of this good practice, he is the last man among them. Therefore, Ananda, I say to you, continue this good practice instituted by me and do not be the last man. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there being, obviously this being the kind of the bringing home the Dhamma point here, but one thing which is, I think, quite significant in terms of understanding Buddhist history, to notice that, of course, this being the Jataka story, the Buddha identifying himself as being the king in the past. Now, in the developed or the form of the Jataka stories which we're familiar with, the whole purpose of the Jataka story is to say, well, this is the practice which the Bodhisattva did in his past life, which has led up to his enlightenment in this life. Okay? That's what a Jataka story is. But in this canonical Jataka, as with all the canonical Jatakas, the Buddha is not saying that at all. In fact, in this one, and this particular passage is found in a few other suttas, in this one he quite explicitly states that that practice which he did not lead to nibbana. It only led to reappearance in the Brahma realm. Okay, so please notice this very carefully. So the whole idea that the practices that the Bodhisattva did in his past life, well, notice that the word Bodhisattva is not used here, of course, but the practices which the Siddhartha did in his past lives, the idea that they led to enlightenment, it's not merely absent from the early scriptures, but in fact directly contradicts the early scriptures. So again, to notice that he's saying quite clearly and explicitly that kind of good practice does not lead to nibbana. And when he comes down here to say what is the practice that does lead to nibbana, and of course the Noble Eightfold Path, and this leads to complete disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, and so on. And this, of course, being more or less a paraphrase of the basic standard passage first taught in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, being almost a direct quote from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where he was saying it's these Dhammas which were Pubbeyana Nusute Sudhammesu, those Dhammas which were not learnt from me from another, these were the ones which I practiced to lead to enlightenment. Okay?
Is it, a while ago when you said something like the Buddha found the eightfold path in his past life, the last human life.
Sorry, what do you mean by the last life? Do you mean this life as Gautama, or in his previous existence? In his life as Gautama, yeah?
And then you said something like, when I asked you what was the reference to any kind of examples you can give, you gave, I think it wasn't this one, but it's another one that when the Buddha was talking about when he was a king, and that didn't help him to find a noble path.
Yeah.
But I think in one of the sutta, he was Jyotipala.
Uh-huh.
He was actually the disciple of the last Buddha.
Yeah.
Then he already know that path. Then can you see it as all his past life he was working towards it, rather than he suddenly found it in his last
life? We had quite a long discussion on this. Were you around when we had that discussion?
I asked you this in my first interview.
Yeah, no, we had quite a long discussion that maybe you were on retreat or something at the time. Yeah, so because we did do the Gatikara Sutta, so it would be one of the most recent ones, so maybe have a look at that. We'll discuss that in some detail. But the basic problem there with the Gatikara Sutta is that it's really the identification of the Buddha as, or the Siddhartha as Jyotipala, is really quite arbitrary to the sutta itself. It's not really intrinsic to the text, and it's only really just in one line at the end that you find that identification. So that kind of thing is, to me, is very kind of thin in terms of, you know, as a general principle, you shouldn't sort of overturn sort of well-established and strongly established Dharma principles on the basis of an occasional or kind of one-off passage. So in this case, the idea that the Buddha, you know, as he said in the Dhammacakka Sutta, pubbeyananusatesu dhammesu, those dhammas which I didn't learn from another, that's a very, very strongly established principle. So I'd be very reluctant to overturn or to even qualify that based on something like the Gatikara Sutta.
So even though, again, that doesn't really contradict directly, if you learned the life before, you could have forgotten.
Yeah, except it says, I didn't learn it from another, pubbeyananusatesu dhammesu.
Have you never?
That's what it says.
Mm.
But what we did discuss in the Gatikara Sutta class was Anaglio's essay on that topic, which came about a week after that class.
Right.
And it goes through very, very carefully how it's problematic, and also proposes a reason.
There was a subsequent essay he came up with shortly after, as it happens. Yeah.
So you have a read about that?
It was printed out. At the time, I don't know where it came from. No, there was another one that came out. I'll see if we can print that out again.
It's really, really good. It's very, very clear.
Yeah. That's one of the problems, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the issues. You know, it's a very emphatic point. You know, he kind of, it's his first discourse, and he's repeating it again and again, and it's quite an emphatic, major, central kind of idea. I mean, I personally don't think the situation with the Gatikara Sutra and Jyotipala is particularly significant, but I think more of an issue is a kind of the general principle that he did recollect his past lives. He did the Tevija on the night before his enlightenment, and so just in general, kind of you would have thought that you know, if he'd practiced Dhamma in previous lifetimes, that he would have remembered that. Again, that's just not what it says. You know, it says very clearly, I've never heard this from anyone else before. And it's a very, very strong message. You know, even like the first upaka, when he meets his first wanderer after his enlightenment, and he says, "Acharyo me nati, I have no teacher." Again, it just seems to me is incredibly ungrateful. If he really actually learnt it from a past Buddha or from someone in the past, and not to actually mention it, and not to say, "Oh, I feel incredible gratitude to Buddha Kassapa or whoever for having taught me these things," you know. But again, that's just. But it doesn't say that it's in the context of that life. It just says, I've never learnt this from anyone else before. So,
English being this particular one now, it just strikes me as being really late kind of hand on the text. The Buddha's kind of identifying with it. You may think that I was that, I was this, it's kind of like it goes against just the feel of the usual Buddha's teaching in terms of pen origination, various other factors which seem to be more important than identifying with being a visual out of a past life. To me, it just kind of creates this tweet in my mind, which is kind of thinking, how many of these kind of, I used to be that kind of guy. Stories are there in the suttas, and is there only like two or three of them?
There's a bit more than two or three, but yeah, there's not that many.
And how important are they? Is this a formulaic thing that just falls onto the end, so they can't quite finish off the sutta copy or something?
It occurs in the same thing. When you practice, for example, yoga, you find even before I came to Buddhism, I practiced yoga.
Yeah.
And there were certain things, and there wasn't the framework of the Four Noble Truths, but it does not mean that I did not practice certain things. And so when I came to the teaching of the Buddha, I realized I actually was doing various things, but I wasn't aware of the framework. And I feel this also explains why, the early disciples, they didn't need a lot of rules and things, because they already practiced various things. So, in that view, it's kind of beyond he knew the Dharma or didn't know the Dharma. See what I mean? He practiced certain things, but the framework, the holistic view, and seeing he didn't have. That's one way of looking at it.
Certainly that, he's quite, as we noticed with the four Brahma Viharas, that he's quite happy to adopt things in there. And as you say, that the framework is very characteristic of Buddhism.
In
this
first year of our college, the power of his enlightenment,
reflection of past lives.
Why would you need to bond with the next two? If you could relate the past, if you could relate past lives, and you could say, well, I'm a customer of Buddha, and he taught me this is the first time I've heard the second. What's the point of going through all the problems of seeing beings arising and passing away? It's a bit far fetched.
Maybe a little bit overly literal. reading of it, but. Yeah?
So I don't call the account of the previous Buddha, just sort of a kind of a meter. Maybe he sort of like gives the gifts and I can just wander off, doesn't sit around and listen to the crystals.
Well, in the Gatakara Sutra, your dance is a monk. Yeah, look, maybe it's just a bad monk.
He just sort of dancing, the Buddha's just off you go.
Yeah, it could have been. But I mean, it just, as soon as you're talking about past lives, you're in the realm of mythology, and whether or not the Buddha, even leaving aside any questions of any literal truth to any of it, whether there are past lives or whether the Buddha recollected past lives or anything like that, as soon as you're in that realm, the way that the stories and the texts have been constructed have been massively informed by mythological concepts, and so the our ability to even extract meaningful historical information, even from the actual events of the Buddha's life, like say the Parinibbana or something like that, is even pretty minimal. and we have to struggle. And any attempt to sort of attribute a meaningful, historical, sort of rational, sort of consistent or coherent principle to these events in past life suttas is really, I think, quite misguided. It's more just about seeing, you know, what are the stories and what were the dhammas and so on, the principles that were practiced in those kinds of things. And I really think it's a serious mistake to start using these kinds of stories as a principle which could even really inform or have anything to do with our understanding of the Dhamma as such.
Anali, as I said, just for those who won't get around to reading it, he basically talks about how by making that mistake, the redactors of the text shifted the emphasis of what may have been the original text from the story about the potter and the virtues of the potter to a story about the bodhisattva. So he does textual analysis, comparative analysis, and shows how the later you go in the text, the more the emphasis shifts from this is the emphasis of the potter, this is what the Dhamma is, this is what is good, to this is what a bodhisattva does. And so, you know, the hypothesis is that what they were trying to do by tacking on the end, the identification of Jotapala as the Buddha in past life, is to somehow justify things like why the Buddha had to go through ascetic practices, trying to fit together the whole bodhisattva idea that he practiced in many lives, and yet in his past life, despite doing all these paramis, he still had to go through these ascetic practices. Because as Jotapala, he made fun of the world.
So the situation similar to that Bishop Sprong's claim for early Christianity?
In what way?
He was saying that he had a radical idea that he was limited by cultural concepts of Baal at the time, made clay at the time, stuffed with the way they see things, and a huge framework. That's the way they work with it. So you end up.
Yeah. I mean, no doubt that plays its part to some extent. But just finish off on Arlo's essay here. He actually discusses some of these issues a little bit further on. Looking back on the various versions of the present discourse, it's noteworthy how the Ekottara Agama version integrates various narrative pieces into their account, such as the detailed description of the seven treasures of the wheel-turning king, the need for his successor to receive instruction in proper rulership, and the general deterioration of living conditions and morality due to improper rulership, narrative elements which in the Pali Nikayas are found in the Mahasudassana Sutta and the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta. So as so often, we find that these different sections are found in the Pali and the other collections, but they're organized differently. The Ekottara Agama version thus seems to freely avail itself of various narrative elements or motives, motifs, from the early Buddhist oral tradition and to incorporate them into the present discourse. Another point worthy of further attention is the agreement between the Pali and Chinese versions that King Makadeva spent four time periods of 84,000 years as a child, a prince, a king, and a recluse. The same versions also agree that King Makadeva's descendants kept up the same way of acting for altogether 84,000 generations. Four times 84,000 years, and that for 84,000 generations would mean that this tradition lasted for over 28 billion years. As this by far exceeds the age of the planet Earth, it is obvious that such numbers are not meant literally. That doesn't quite follow. It's not obvious that the numbers were not meant literally. Yeah. Obviously that they can't be literally true, but the authors may well have meant them literally. Whether or not they did or not, but you know, they could have done. This serves again as a reminder that numbers in an oral tradition are better not taken at their numerical value. I would correct this here. I don't think It's got anything to do with being an oral tradition, it's got to do with being a mythic tradition. The idea of 84,000 years or generations appears to go back to the number 7, taken from the number of days in a week, and thus stands for a complete time cycle. And it has a footnote here down to a little note in the Pali Text Society dictionary that number 7, whose application has spread from the week of 7 days, is a number invested with a peculiar magic nimbus. And according to Dumont, blah, 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 the number 7 in ancient India indicates a totality. Exactly, 12 sevens, yeah. So the symbolism of the number 7 can be seen in a Jataka account which describes a long time it took a hunter to reach a remote area to have been 7 years, 7 months and 7 days. Another instance is found in the discourse in Guttara and Madhyama Agama, according to which the Buddha in a past life practiced love and kindness for 7 years and a result was not reborn in the sensual world for 7 eons. Yet another example can be found in the Satipatthana Sutta, which speaks of mindfulness practice undertaken for various time periods ranging between 7 years and 7 days. Noteworthy that after counting down by single years from 7 years to 1 year, the Satipatthana Sutta next speaks of 7 months, after which it counts down by a single month to 5 months, 6, 5 months, etc. This presentation were to follow a numerical logic, one would expect the Satipatthana Sutta to proceed from a single year to 11 months instead. This suggests that its use of numbers is to some extent influenced by the symbolic value of the number 7. 7 is a basic temporal unit multiplied by the 12 months of the year results in 84. 84 further enhanced by being multiplied by 1,000 leads to the number 84,000, a number indicating a very long time span. Hence, why would it be 7 by 3 by 4?
Because 7 by 3 by 4 is
4. Yes. And what's 3 and what's 4?
3 plus 4 is 7.
I got that.
Can we not refocus on
that? No. What is the 3 and the 4? Because obviously the twelve is the twelve. That's tricky. So do I need a calculator to help work with that? The 12 being the 12 months. 12 being the 12 months of the year. Not in India. In India they had 3 seasons. To take such knit numbers too literally would not only imply losing sight of the oral nature of the discourses, but also miss the main point of the present account. The depiction of a harmonious succession of kings in the Makadeva Sutta appears to involve a subtle criticism of rulership in ancient India. To appreciate this, it needs to be borne in mind that King Pasenadi passed away while trying to rally forces against his son who had usurped the throne, and that King Bimbisara was cruelly put to death by his son Ajatasattu in a bid for power. Against this background, the description of the peaceful succession of 84,000 kings who at the slightest indication of old age are willing to abdicate and spend the rest of their life secluded from sensual pleasures in meditative renunciation would not have failed to make its effect on the ancient Indian audience. In this way, the Makadeva Sutta, with a touch of humour, not sure about the humorous bit with people killing things, it highlights the superiority of renunciation over the insatiable drive for the power over Indian kings, a drive for power that manifested particularly strongly during this period of beginning its political centralisation in ancient India. I think that's a very good point, and there is certainly a model of ideal kingship which is being presented here. Of course, the Buddha is not, in this particular text, he's not passing judgment on sort of kingship versus democracy, but he's simply giving that story. But certainly, the succession of kingship was not merely a problem in those two examples which Analia gives, but in fact was a massive ongoing problem for the whole of Indian history and elsewhere, and has resulted in a lot of particular cultural mechanisms, including the very widespread practice of divine regicide, the killing of the king according to periods, which again was often done in accordance with these kinds of symbolic number frames. So a king might be killed after a 7-year reign or something like that, in one way that it would be done. But then the use of the number 7 and the symbolism of that we've noted many times before in discussions of mythology and so on. And I think that it's important when reading this kind of literature to get a familiarity with the conventions that are used, whether consciously or unconsciously, by the authors, who are almost these are almost like markers or tips which are telling you that we've now entered into a mythological time and a mythological space. And it's similar to in paintings, where, you know, when you give someone a halo, for example, or something like this, is you're kind of deliberately lifting them out of the mundane world of ordinary concerns. And so this repeated use of the number 7 being a classical example of that. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, very common, and it's inherited from the Rig Veda and also found in the Bible and Mesopotamia and just about everywhere else, yeah.
I find it very curious. The contrast between the king renounces and experiences the joys of renunciation.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The non-worldly. And then you have the justice of
Nimi.
Yeah. Sort of absolutely over the top descriptions of palaces. And it's just over the top description of the
century.
Is that
the thing to Joe? Oh, Annie, that's absolutely typical of the whole Indian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's the very power and spellbinding effect of the sensual pleasures which make the renunciation even more powerful. So in order to create the effect, that's like one of the, if perhaps even not the most basic techniques used in Indian literature and art, is to precisely to create that tension through the most extravagant descriptions of all the sensual pleasures and so on, which go on at incredible length. And then to bring in the contrast with renunciation. So you find that tension being played with all the time in Indian literature.
So, I remember going to the Red Fort in Delhi. And then the descriptions of what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a Mughal influence. But obviously that they espoused the actual rulers in some time in the night. They
actually, this was like
these dream palaces in the air.
They tried
to actually create them.
Well, definitely, yeah. I mean, the Taj Mahal is definitely an example, yeah. Absolutely.
So,
Yeah.
It's interesting how the effect of that literature has on the minds of different cultures. So if we were to say to a person from a traditional culture that we aspire to become a monastic,
mm.
and we start, that's such a difficult thing to do.
Mm.
That's very brave, that's very admirable. Whereas if I said to like one of my Western friends, monastic, I would go, that's really dumb.
Mm.
And then from my own perspective, it's, you know, I'm coming to ask you, to me, it's like it's no particularly big deal.
Mm.
I found it so interesting. I had a story of a monk who, his mother was ill, and then she sort of said, you have to obey. And then she said, if you just go by, kill my son. So he lived very long, his mother was already 60.
Mm.
And he couldn't start a family anymore when she was still alive, and he couldn't be spoke.
Mm.
And just stayed alone for his whole life, and in the Western part, then brother said, if you are gay now, kill my son. Then the other way around.
Yeah, I had a surprise moment when we started to do the Yellow Pages. I was just looking for the King of the
that's quite deep on the ancient Indian mind, just that's the place they hide.
Mm.
But the Western mind, the sort of description of high education is pretty, pretty different, not a dry thing reasonable for me.
Yeah, yeah. You have to, you know, and in the Quran, it's like a kind of an oasis with water and plenty of dates and stuff like that.
But it's still there in positive terms, I think. People who such as Parvish Poor Last, Calcutta, and that negative rupees, and
outrageous
Hollywood films.
Yeah.
Why are
the
types
of spirits living in the same?
Yeah.
Pure escape.
Yeah. And they just love it.
Yeah. Because it's
escapism. Yeah.
Is in the Bible, they also have these characters who lived for thousands of years.
Hundreds. Okay, they have the patriarchs in like 800 years and stuff like that, yeah.
I'm sure that also has. So the readership of those people who have a story that would have probably different significance and it would to some degree of people hearing that now. Yeah.
It was, although the scale of numbers in the Indian tradition is much bigger than in the Western tradition. In the Semitic and the Greek mythology, you know, it's a very small scale. You know, like the Greek mythology only happened over like 3 or 4 generations, basically. It's very interesting why that difference is there. Whereas from Mesopotamia east, you get these literally astronomical numbers, and of course all these numbers are derived from astronomy. That's how the mathematicians work them out. You know, you basically have a cycle of the moon and a cycle of the movements of the planets, and a lot of it actually comes from trying to reconcile these different cycles. So you say, well, this planet might have a cycle that goes through 12 years and that other one has a cycle that goes through 15 years, but when do those two cycles meet up? So that's when you have to sort of multiply all these, because they assumed that you had like one point where everything was perfectly aligned, so you had like a starting point, and so you trace how far does it get back to where the starting point happens, and that's like the start of the calendar cycle or the start of the eon. And so once you start to multiply all of the cycles together, that's when you start to get these numbers which are literally astronomical.
It also helps with cultures like abacus and all mathematical tools.
Yeah, well, they didn't have abacus in, as far as I know, in India and Mesopotamia, but they obviously had advanced mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Hebrews and the Greeks didn't seem to have, maybe they just didn't have it during their mythic period. I mean, obviously the Greeks had good maths afterwards, which they learnt from the Babylonians and so on. Perhaps it's difficult to say. It might have something to do with the climate. That when you're, I always think that when you're in like a desert land or much more open land, the sky is much more impressive. Whereas Greece is much more hemmed in. Greece is like cliffs and sort of cut off bits. They're quite small. Like the lands and the kingdom and so on is quite small and isolated from each other. So that may have something to do with it.
It's more precise in that kind of environment too.
Yeah, that's much smaller. Yeah. Yeah. But,
okay. How much value did you say then to this Buddhist cosmology? Because obviously the heavens are this discovery, which is so unreal. And so, I mean, this universe, we have actual real evidence, people recollecting their previous lives.
Yeah.
But I haven't read much that would sound sensible about anything, you know, any higher plane.
Yeah.
But, I just wonder.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, I mean, I would, I mean, I think that's something which does demand a lot more evidence and inquiry than we have available at the moment. But I would distinguish, in the Buddhist scriptures, I would distinguish between the basic principle of rebirth, which is taught in things like, say, dependent origination, the Theravija, like the threefold knowledges, very central places in the Dhamma, even the Four Noble Truths. And it talks about the basic principles of rebirth and the karma and fruit and things like that, as opposed to the actual sort of detailed descriptions of it, which we've seen just here. And so they're obviously informed by a lot of cultural perceptions and things. Now, obviously, in one sense, the basic principle of it is much more important and is sort of locked into very central Dhamma passages, whereas the actual detailed descriptions are much more peripheral. But also, I think that the way that things are described and experienced and perceived is obviously quite likely would be conditioned by your cultural perception, you know? And that somebody who in an ancient Indian society died with that expectation, oh, I've done good and I'm going to get this divine mansion or something, well, quite possibly that's how they would experience heaven.
Maybe you know? Some imaginary worlds, some projections.
Yeah. Well, it's all, I mean, in Buddhism it's always an interplay between these things anyway. You know, the world is just what we produce through our mind, you know? It's always an interplay, there's not the independence of that. But it's interesting also that for example, there's a very interesting argument in Vasubandhu in his 20 verses. It's one of the most famous treaties in Indian philosophy, about 400 AD. And then he talks about how the world is an illusion, like right? And he gives as an example for his argument the fact that the demons of hell don't really exist, but they're created as a projection of the mind by the people who experience the tortures of hell. Okay, now he's not giving that as a conclusion to his argument. He's not trying to. That's an axiom. He takes it for granted that the people reading this will already, of course, understand that that's obviously the case. And he's saying, well, our world that we experience here and now is constructed in a similar way. Yeah? So it's interesting that perspective was already so taken for granted, at least by some people in those days.
These things are created in one's own mind.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit boring. I think when we see this world,
mm-hmm.
it's powerful. The evil is here, mm-hmm. the way it's going.
Yeah.
It's very powerful.
Well, yeah, if you get.
I take refuge.
Yeah, to get human rebirth in another life. On planet Earth is going to be a bit dicey, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people don't take this seriously. It's, I've seen this program on television documentary. This person going through the history of what kind of food people ate, and it was from middle ages, and it just was so decadent, I would feel ashamed even to say what they ate.
Mm.
Well, they converted meat to different kinds of animal into fruit, they glazed it. But what I felt deeply disappointed, he invited this group of people to the feast, it was on television, and some of them were, I would not thought they would take part in it, and they enjoyed it. They seemed to enjoy it. I had to switch the TV off.
Mm.
It just, after it just was so disgusting, basically. Mm. It made me really, at night, I had nightmares from how can people, they take these animals, a lot of them are factory farms, and they make these fancy stuff, like they make parts of the body I don't even want to mention, they use.
Mm-hmm.
And they mash it up, the meat, and they turn it into fruit and glaze it, and they put it in a bowl and they eat it as fruit.
Mm.
It's kind of decadence that was happening in Middle Ages, and what they said is that apparently there was so much suffering around, people were trying to escape from it into sensual indulgences.
Mm.
And it occurred to me, this is what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
In certain ways. When you see these things, people are looking for escape in the wrong direction.
Absolutely, yeah.
I find it quite traumatizing to see it. Because it kind of dawned on me, the analogy between what was in the Middle Ages and what I see now.
Mm. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's quite difficult to imagine how I feel about that. The people in the hospitals, the animals that are being taken apart alive for the food or for medicine and all, they are really like the descriptions that you have just
heard
about.
You can see it out here. They create it here. Yeah. Look at the animals in China. You know, the dark skin, the people in the dark skin, they are actually, you know, alive on the hot plates while the ducks are alive. The Thai people just put the cobra or the snake, just take the bile or the blood. These are really hell that we have just right here. And the bears, they are cats and creatures, and the bile, so called, if they accept it from them, they use as medicine. The fishes are dipped in the oil, half of the body dipped into oil while it's still alive, and they are being served to the bears while the mouth is still open. Monkeys are being cut on the head to be served the brains while it's still alive. This is really what is hell, right? You can just see it. There are so many types of hell in this world. You don't even have to see it up above, you can see hell here. A lot of people are suffering. And those people with dementia, they're eating their own shit and all that. That's hell. There's so many types of hell in this world. And of course, having those people who are enjoying life, of course, they are happy.
Transient.
This is not to mention.
I think I'm saying that how our cultural perception will determine what heaven's like and what hell's like. So if you're a person who doesn't think it's so bad to, say, laugh at a monk or something like that, what's the big deal? It's in your mind, isn't it? Or say,
sorry, laughing at which mind? Is this laughing at Ajahn Brahm when he tells a joke?
You know, well, it may be a big deal to
say. If you do laugh, you go to hell.
Yeah, in the scriptures it says wrong view, and you know, if you rubbish a monk or something. And I know with Gupta, you know, he says, you know, somebody will say Ajahn Chah's, or rubbish and things like that. You know, a thing like that. It's a cultural perception, isn't it? I mean, it can't be black and white. But
of course.
Yeah, you know, if your mind is, you know, you just think. But then they say wrong view is probably the worst.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. That kind of thing is very typical of religious discourse. You know, it's like in the Muslim, it's sort of the only permanent hell is for those apostates, basically. So if you turn away from Islam, that's the only permanent hell. So it's quite typical of religious discourse that the kind of the worst ones are the ones who disagree with my opinion. I must admit, to a certain degree of scepticism, but also on the other hand, there is something to it in the sense that it's wrong view which conditions a lot of other acts. So for example, some kinds of wrong karma are made, say, out of passion or in the heat of the moment, you know. So, you know, someone might get drunk and beat somebody up and they might die or something like that, so you make a bad karma, but it's just because you're being stupid or something, you know. Whereas somebody who has the wrong view, that's, you know, that's where you get the Holocaust or the, you know, genocide and so on, because it's the view itself which can condition, you know, like a systematic, deliberate program of killing and death. So there, you know, there is a sense in which, you know, view is, you know, not to be not to be neglected.
There are a lot of traditional Buddhists who will say, oh no, it's bad karma, I'll do good karma to get good results. And they're just doing it like a bargaining thing. I think it's actually more courageous to think, well, why not the other way, you know, and to actually think about it rather than just accept it. I don't think it's good to think about it that way, actually.
Definitely. Absolutely. I mean, that aspect of moral courage is very important. You know, the deep insights and the deep understanding will only come when you're not too afraid to ask difficult questions. Absolutely.
Completely deny cause and effect.
Right.
Like probably others would like one to say purification is good, but I have a cruelty in that.
Exactly,
yeah. Pure by heart,
Exactly.
So it's truly gruesome on views, actually. It's just for easier to foster, which is going to go here. Because other
That's right, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can believe in an eternal soul or something like that and you go to heaven because of it. So, yeah, very good point. It's not any kind of wrong view. So you don't have to sort of checking whether your interpretation of vitaka vichara is right, otherwise I'm going to go to hell. No, it's not that. But yeah, as Blake very, very correctly said, it's if you see some of the things with descriptions, you see if you go along the north bank of the Ganges and kill and maim and slaughter everybody, you don't make any, there's no bad that comes from that, you know? And so that's the level of wrong view that you're talking about. Yeah.
But wrong view, like that only wrong view born sort of come from delusion, or is it, can you have a wrong, can you be undeluded and have a wrong view? Like say somebody who's really deluded, might have a particular type of wrong view that creates a sort of bad result, and somebody less deluded would have that same wrong view and create a bad result, and it seems that it wouldn't be so bad because you deluded. Like delusion is one of the defilement.
Yeah, yeah.
That you have to overcome. What I'm really trying to say is, what's the relationship between wrong view or view, your views, and delusion or
typically wrong view is said to be it's an intellectual or conceptual formulation which springs from delusion. So it's like a concrete example of that. But
if you're totally not deluded, then you'll have right view.
Right view will come, but actually the other way around, like right view is a precursor to overcoming delusion.
Right.
In the sense that for most of us when we're practicing, we do what we're doing now, we discuss, read the suttas and so on, and we're gradually correcting our view, and then that leads us to overcoming delusion. And of course they go hand in hand. But view is in a sense shallower than delusion. Yeah.
But it is... It seems to me cut away, delusion.
Yeah.
They go hand in hand.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But it's interesting that you can have someone who's much more. You can have someone who's quite. You can have right view and be quite stupid. But you might have someone else who's much more intelligent. Mm. But have a lot more wrong view.
Mm.
Interesting.
I'm sure you agree with Buddhist right view. So it's all about right view and being delusional. And sort of what it's like, this concrete idea. It's not, it's cultural, it's relational. It depends where you're born and which religious you're born into. And
well,
I
was talking to the Buddhists.
Of course, yeah.
It's like thinking, friends will stop being his friend because he wants to stay in one. I'm sure there is some fear, and I'm sure it's from his point of view, he's trying to save somebody.
It's interesting. In the Indian idiom, the very phrase wrong view is used in a kind of value laden sense, which is a bit different. It's a bit difficult to capture in the English. So, for example, somebody could say, "I have wrong view" in Pali. Well, it means that I believe in things which are harmful or bad or something like that. Well, exactly. You couldn't do that in English. Exactly. So you couldn't do that in English, but so it has a different nuance to it in Pali, which is difficult to capture in English. Yeah. It's perhaps it's like that. There's when people say that it's something like that. There's a sort of socially accepted norm for what right view is, and I'm not conforming with that. Something like that, but anyway, it's a tricky idiom. Yeah, it's a tricky idiom.
It's not right. It's perfect.
Yeah, because I call it noble right here, rather than just more particular.
this reality, that this reality works.
Mm.
I mean, in my case, sometimes I notice that I've had silly ideas about things. I realize this is a silly idea, and yet I've got it to be in that. And what actually does it go to some place where you climb away from it? We've argued until I've been with you, this is the way sort of approach to what's the silly ideas of reality, where those are there. But there's sort of possible notice of these things.
In addition to my experience or my comprehension is more comprehensive. Illusions are more close. Tell that even to my daughter and children that they something I can have this and misconception that's a delusion, often look at it. But as you, it's more a broader thing in my and we have certain frameworks, certain maps of the world that we project over reality. Basically, and sometimes our view can be narrow if we focus. And so we have to step away and our view expands. So there are levels of view as well.
Oh, definitely,
So it's relative as well.
Yeah.
But within that relativity, there is, we see, like we study science, you can see this view is limited there, it doesn't match that. It's like seeing different people looking through at reality with different models in their minds, and we constantly re-changing and improving our models and frameworks, how we perceive things. But as long as we don't grasp to that this is me or this is the ultimate.
Sometimes I think with delusion, the models in mind are something very skewed.
Yes.
So that your view, so it's almost as it might be impossible to have right now.
Experience from there, doesn't it? It's sort of getting rid of the wrong views and then talking about the six sense spaces and things like that. So it's moving towards experience. Okay, so probably enough for today. So 6 o'clock. So thanks everyone. And next week we'll be looking at Madhya Nikaya number 84, the Madhura Sutta. And the Madhura Sutta being having some quite interesting little bits in there, some interesting historical significance as well.
Sarang Sambuddho Bhagava Guru Nam Bhagava Nam Abhivah.